Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. When young adult author Jennifer Latham decided to write about the Tulsa race riot, she knew she was entering into a complex history that still raises questions today about the events surrounding that 1921 night when Greenwood was burned to the ground, 8,000 black Tulsans lost everything they owned, and at least 300 people died. But the extent of those questions and how contemporary they remain today only became readily apparent through each day's news as she was writing the book. In the words of one of her characters, "The crime's different, but the problem's the same. It's about power and prejudice rooted so deep people don't see it anymore." In his headlines about Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, Eric Harris, and others made news, Latham knew she was writing about today as much as 1921. Now, at the end of a long week that has seen bitter debates and arguments within families, workplaces, and online about the fate of 100-year-old statues and the naming of schools and other landmarks, her book Dreamland Burning subtitle seems prescient. You can't bury the truth forever. And her book offers interweaving teenage perspectives on race in 1921 leading up to the events of the race riot and today, crossing historical fiction with a cold case murder mystery that's a page-turner. She'll be featured along with fellow Tulsa author Julia Thomas and food writer David Leet at Chapters, Tulsa City County Library's fundraiser for adult literary services, which is coming up early next month, Thursday, September 7th at the Hardesty Regional Library. She joins us today to talk about her new book, which is now being read in classrooms here in Tulsa, Dreamland Burning. Jennifer Latham, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Your latest book, Dreamland Burning, has had this really amazing run since it came out in the fall. Already, the book's being used in Tulsa public schools. What has that reaction been like?
It's been slowly unfolding, but really, really gratifying. It's a heavy topic to write a book for teens about. And my publisher was behind me from the get-go, but it was a very low-key release. There was not a ton of publicity done for it. And the nicest thing about it has been that the story and the importance of the events that happened in Tulsa in 1921 have really been behind what's kept the book going.
And I would think, given the events of just the last few weeks, it's just as important today as the historical fiction you were writing about, almost 100 years ago.
Very unfortunately
So now you're not a native Oklahoman or native Tulsan. Tell us about how you learned about the race riot and how you used that research to craft this story.
Well, the funny thing is I've lived in Tulsa now for more years than I lived anywhere else because
you're
I grew up in the Army.
Brat.
Yeah. So this is by a lot of years. This is home. And I had read about, and I'll use the word race riot, even though that is very controversial and I'm fully aware that it was more of a race massacre. But historically, texts tend to refer to it as a riot.
It was a riot by whites.
It was a riot by
against
whites,
the African-American community.
I initially heard about it through some New York Times articles in the 90s. But where I really started to think it might be something to write a fictional account of was when I visited the Greenwood Historical Center with some 7th and 8th graders. I was an absolutely abysmal English teacher for 1 year. I trained as a school psychologist, but for that 1 year, they were desperate in a private school, and I stepped in and did that. But apart from getting to spend time with some wonderful kids, we did visit the center, and I was really struck by the wall of photographs of survivors. And it was, I think, the juxtaposition of seeing those photographs and being with a group of 7th and 8th graders that really started to get the wheels turning in my head, thinking this might be something to look into. So I actually began by reading some historians' accounts that were based on interviews with survivors. The survivors' stories, to me, are the most critical element to building a believable world and really reflecting the thoughts and feelings of people who were there at the time. I found a lot of digital archives that contained interviews with survivors as well as a few in print, and the Tulsa City County Library was great for that. Their website has a lot. The Historical Society also has an app that they developed to help you explore some of the documents and photographs that are left from 1921. And TU actually was a tremendous help because the official race riot archives are here. Mm. And Mark Carlson, who was the head librarian there, was wonderful. I got to go through, unfortunately, not many documents because a lot were destroyed, but 2 to 3 legal boxes that had things like National Guard records, letters, a lot about the aftermath of the events, which unfortunately led to nothing happening other than the residents of Greenwood essentially being blamed for what happened and no one being liable to help them rebuild.
Right, and having to rebuild pretty much on their own and really with the system gamed against them, because there was a lot of efforts to basically, through zoning and insurance issues, to deprive them of the land where their structures once stood.
Exactly. And actually, B.C. Franklin was critical in helping right. prevent some of the attempted zoning laws from going through. He represented survivors. And that's part of the reason that the term riot is so controversial. Because it was deemed a riot, insurance companies were able to deny Greenwood residents claims, saying that it was an act of man rather than an act of God. Mm. So no one received any compensation for their property loss.
Yeah. So you were able to read all these eyewitness accounts. Now, you said you're reading eyewitness accounts of the survivors. Now, that's part of the story that you tell in Dreamland Burning, but actually your main character from 1920 and 1921 is actually a white Osage Indian young man. So he's telling the story from the perspective of somewhat of white privilege. Were there many accounts of that side? I wouldn't think there would be.
I think at a certain point, and what's so interesting about Tulsa is you don't know. Of course, there are accounts from Native Americans, but they're not necessarily labeled as such. So right. a lot of Greenwood residents were descendants or actually freedmen or women themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the most interesting research I did was on the title for our own house, which is in Midtown. In the original document in our title, which I pulled out and kept very unwisely in the upstairs closet for a year, was the original documents where the United States government ceded the land to the Muscogee Creek tribe. Mm-hmm. And the second set of documents were the papers where the tribe ceded the land over to a young freed woman who was Muscogee Creek. And her name was America Manuel. And she was a brown-skinned descendant of slaves, and she was 17 years old. So it actually worked beautifully and made me think that Tulsa is a very, very multicultural town. And it was founded by, in large part, the Perryman family, who were themselves Native American. And if you look at photographs, there's this wonderful rainbow of skin colors, and they were a family, yet they all looked very different in that photograph.
One of the protagonists is William Tillman, who is his father's white, his mother is Osage. He has a lot of the privileges of being white, although to certain members of the community, the Klan members of the community, he's very much suspect as a half Indian. But you said it from that perspective, and I'm just wondering how, you know, we're in his thought processes, and he's experiencing a lot of moments of the privileges of being, of not being black, at least in mm-hmm. Tulsa in this age. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if there were any accounts that sort of gave you insight into that, because I would think nobody would write those oral histories down.
You're right. And I went by the seat of my pants, but also very carefully by the seat of my pants, because I felt that it would be wrong not to represent Tulsa in 1921 as having a lot of Native American residents. Mm-hmm. I felt it was necessary to include that in a vital way. And Will's mother is a full-blood Osage who receives actually 3, because family members of hers have passed away. She has 3 head rights for oil income, so they're a fairly wealthy family. I proceeded very carefully and unfortunately was unable to find truly how Native Americans would have been perceived by members of the Klan. And this was a really tricky research element. I'm grateful Brian Hosmer here, Dr. Brian Hosmer mm-hmm. at the University of Tulsa, was wonderful. And his basic answer was, it was tricky. it depended on a case-to-case basis, of course, by skin color, by the amount of money an individual had. Money is frequently a mitigating factor in an individual's treatment. So I proceeded very carefully, but also felt it was very necessary to include at least reference to the tragedy that happened just a few years after the race riot in Pawhuska, with Osage tribal members being killed, as David Grant speaks about in Killers of the Flower Moon, which I would highly recommend.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it was just a few years later that all of a sudden it's Osage Indians that are facing their own sort of riot of race through mysterious deaths, murders, really, for those head rights.
Yes. And actually the legislation that set that phenomenon up, where Osage
you
tribal
allude to it,
That happened just before the race riot.
Yeah, and in fact, Will's father becomes the guardian of his mother.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, so you have this story. William Tillman, the first incident in the book is he and his buddy go out to sort of a shady speakeasy, or being in Tulsa, it was like a roadhouse somewhere, and they see a girl from school. She's sitting down with an African-American young man. And immediately it's like, how, in the language of the novel, how can that boy consider doing that? Mm-hmm. And the boy being very much as a dirty word as have you ever heard.
Mm-hmm.
And he provokes an incident in this bar. And from there, the story takes on. How important was that to start with that particular episode for you?
Very important. I needed to start off with Will being in the wrong and having part of an arc of a story in any good novel, especially a young adult novel, is that there is change, that the characters move and transform over the course of the story. Will, I wanted him to have a long way to go.
He's a very weak character.
He is a product of his time, and he's a product of a lack of critical thinking. He's a 17-year-old boy who's never been challenged in the way that society has taught him to think. So it was a hard scene to write, and a few readers said, you can't write that. but I think I'm glad we stuck with it, because I think it does set up.
Did you get pushback from your editors at all?
Never from editors, from Tulsans who read it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, the editors actually, this book had three editors, because publishing is a really tricky business, and three different individuals worked on it with me. They were always very supportive. And this was a tricky novel in terms of language, because in order to represent dialogue and thoughts in 1921, there are some ugly words being used. And I didn't want to gloss over the way that people would think or speak in 1921. But at the same time, those are very hard words for most individuals to hear and grapple with. They're ugly.
Now, Will's father owns, I guess what you'd call an appliance shop. He owns a record shop.
Victrola shop.
At that particular point. Across the street or nearby is another business owner who's very much part of the Klan.
Absolutely.
And that was, I guess that sets up your tension for this story, at least a good part of the story.
Mm-hmm. The Klan had actually just started coming into Oklahoma in 1921. There were members, but it was a time of active recruitment where recruiters were being paid for bringing in individual members who would sign up and join. So after the riot, the membership exploded. But at the time the riot occurred, it was really just starting to build steam. So I tried to make it clear that the racism that led to Greenwood being destroyed was not solely because of the KKK.
It was just there.
It was just, yeah.
And I think that's the important thing about that opening episode where the African-American young man that is accosted in the bar, the police come and take a report. And the police says, we'll take care of this.
Mm-hmm.
And it is taken care of, where he's beaten brutally. We find out later in the novel. And that wasn't necessarily KKK related. That was just whites keeping African Americans in their place.
Absolutely. And there were
by 1920 standards.
Yes. Yeah. And as is the case, individual policemen were individual human beings. But I would say that in 1921, a fair share of Tulsa police and sheriff officers considered themselves vigilantes and having they were like Judge Dredd out handing out mm-hmm. judgment and punishment in one. And certainly that wasn't true for everyone. In fact, the Sheriff Bill McCullough, who was the sheriff who took Dick Rowland, thank mm-hmm. you, to the courthouse and protected him from the mob, one of his deputies was actually an African-American. So there were African-Americans on the sheriff and police forces as well, but they were by no means the majority.
Yeah. My guest today is Jennifer Latham, author of Dreamland Burning, a young adult novel that is really taken off about the Tulsa race riot. It's actually set in two time periods, in 1921 and in sort of present day, if you will. And she's one of the featured authors at Chapters, the Tulsa City County Library's fundraiser for adult literary services, which is coming up Thursday, September 7th at the Hardesty Regional Library, which will also feature food writer David Leet and a mystery writer, Julia Thomas.
Who's also a Tulsan.
Yes, who's also a Tulsan as well. And Jennifer Latham is my guest today. Well, you have this second story, which is set in present day, I assume somewhere around Brady Heights. Is that right?
Rowan lives in Maple Ridge.
Maple Ridge. Okay, yeah. Maple Ridge. That's right. And Rowan Chase is a young mixed race young lady, daughter of a man who runs an oil company with his name on it. Mm-hmm. Privileged in her own way, economically. Was this always a part of the story to sort of set it in present day and in the past, or did that come about through the process of writing?
I had always envisioned the novel starting with the discovery of something. Initially, it was a gun, and I settled on instead a skeleton.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't imagined the character being mixed race. I had imagined writing it from the perspective of a white person. But honestly, the more I did the historical research, it took roughly 2.5 years before I truly started digging in and building the story. Over the course of those 2.5 years, the news showed violence against unarmed African Americans, and it became very much a part of how I started to think about the events of 1921, and I realized that it was silly not to show that some of the underlying social forces and institutionalized approaches that led to the riot are still shaping interactions of whites and African Americans today.
Yeah. How did that affect the writing of the novel, the fact that, you know, Trayvon Martin, you know, the shooting in Ferguson, you know, all these, you know, Michael Brown, all of these cases that were coming up. In fact, there's a character that alludes to this, a friend of a Rowan that's talking about what's going on today. How did that affect your writing?
It slowed it down because it's a really difficult thing to think about. And I don't say slow down in a, it made writing harder kind of way. It slowed it down because it made me think more fully about the implications of 1921. And my perspective as a white writer writing a book about a very difficult subject, and that in and of itself is a slightly controversial thing. And I am happy to acknowledge that and have had really wonderful discussions, especially with high school students, both white and African-American, about the importance of talking, that this is an extremely difficult subject. It's hard to write about. It's hard to talk about. But it is a shared subject. This issue affects everyone. And
how big a part of that was in your mind as you're, you know, just as you're trying to write a narrative? I mean, you're writing a narrative, but I would think you couldn't get away from the fact I'm a white writer writing about this event in which, you know, my background says I have all the privilege of a story in which your characters don't. Some of your characters don't.
Right. Both my primary narrators, and that's probably part of the reason they both are from mixed cultural heritages, and they both do have an element of privilege that kind of tweaks their racial experience as individuals and the way they think about issues of race. So I think I modified in order to have, because I knew that my perspective would necessarily be skewed, and I can't truly represent the feelings of a young person, say, who grew up in Greenwood and what their experiences would have been. So although I do have characters who grew up in Dreamland, the primary impetus behind the story is the perspective of characters who do have an element of financial, if not racial, privilege. It was a tricky thing, absolutely. And part of putting the book out there, I hope, is to say this is history. It's history that's important, that needs to be explored and discussed. And the only way we have that discussion and open up dialogue is by being willing to put ourselves out there.
Yeah. Now, one of the things you were talking about, you said this idea of Dreamland, the name of the book, Dreamland Burning. There's a certain attraction in the eyes of William from his, and there's actually, it's at the very end of the book and sort of the very beginning of the book, of this view of his first sight of the Greenwood District. How did you know, it's like, even I've been through a lot of the archives, it's really hard to get a sense of what that area was like before the race riot.
Part of that is just the joy of being a writer and getting to spend a lot of time in your head imagining. And I think that's what led me to be willing to write characters of color, is mm-hmm. that it's an important element to being a writer, that you need to be able to put yourself in the shoes of others. That's the essence of writing fiction, is imagining characters. But at the same time, of course, I had to know what restaurants were in Greenwood, what shops were there. And for that, newspapers were incredibly helpful. So not just the Tulsa World and the Tulsa Tribune, but the Oklahoma Star, and I believe it was the Oklahoma Eagle. There were two African-American-owned mm-hmm. newspapers in Greenwood. And the advertisements were wonderful. They're what made me have a good grasp of what was going on in Greenwood. If you wanted to go out to dinner, what was on the menu? Who owned the restaurants? What were people talking about? There was an article in the Star about dolls, and should there be brown skin dolls for brown skinned children? And the editorial or the writer said, well, of course. And so little elements like that came out in the story, where Joseph and Ruby, who are both residents of Greenwood and become friends with Will over the course of the story, Joseph actually stains a white rag doll for Ruby with tea so that she can have a doll who actually looks like her.
Yeah. You know, it's really interesting. I was looking at some papers from about the mid-30s, and the style of writing was so different, because it sort of took on the form of a small town newspaper here in Tulsa. Even these are the World and the Tribune, mm-hmm. but they had this element of a sort of a small town, where it sort of had a degree of familiarity in the style of writing, that the reader is going to recognize, mm-hmm. you know, what they're talking about. And it was really interesting to go back to those articles. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming the same was true for you.
Absolutely. And it was true. It was a folksier style of writing, even in the larger city newspapers like the New York Times and the Washington Post.
Mm. My guest today is Jennifer Latham. She's the author of Dreamland Burning, a really beautiful young adult novel, writing about this horrific incident in our history, the Tulsa race riot, but through the eyes of a young man from 1921 and a present day person, Rowan Chase, a young girl in Maple Ridge. And of course, you bring these two stories together over the course of the novel. Can you talk maybe about that process of bringing these two stories? I assume that was always that once you decided you're going to have it in the present day and the past, there has to be a linkage. But can you talk about figuring out a way to make it so believable as you do in this case?
Sure. It was tricky, and Will's voice honestly came to me much easier than Rowan's. Will is the 1921 narrator, because he basically talks like my grandfather. His father would have come from Pennsylvania, the Ohio area. That's where a lot of people moving to Oklahoma had come from. So he felt very comfortable for me in terms of his speech patterns. Mm-hmm. Rowan was trickier, because I actually know young women who are biracial, who are living in Tulsa, experiencing what it's like today. And so there was more pressure there. These are my kids' friends. These are kids I know. And I wanted to be sure I represented her experience thoughtfully. But in terms of actually structuring the chapter-by-chapter alternation, it was tricky. So what I ended up doing was writing first a Will chapter and then a Rowan chapter. I couldn't just go through and write all of Will's sections.
Really? I would think it would be easier to sort of figure out where to put them together later, but you actually did that way.
Because it's a murder mystery.
Oh, right.
And to unspool clues, which in Will's timeline we're moving forward in time as he describes what happened prior to June 1st is when the real burning took place. He's moving towards that event, whereas Rowan finds a skeleton and is looking backwards. So I had the dual problem of the clues unfolding from different perspectives, but also I had to layer the events that produced the clues that Rowan finds, like a wallet, or I don't want to give anything away.
Right, right.
But it got extremely tricky. So I went chapter by chapter and had yellow sticky notes on each chapter basically describing the major clues that were given away so that I could be sure they unfolded.
Now, both of these characters, as we mentioned, are mixed race.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to give anything away, but there's yet another character that we find out is mixed race. How important was that fact? Without giving any too much away, how important was that fact to the overall story?
To the overall story, I don't believe it was important at all. In retrospect, some readers might choose to think about why that particular character does end up being mixed race. I'll just fess up now. After a day of writing, my favorite way to just clear my head is to watch old Law and Order episodes. And this particular character, that element of the story.
I know this.
It is. There are points where writers aren't so much having deep thoughts about their characters as they are just picking up elements of their day-to-day lives and dumping them in the book.
Well, you're, of course, going to be talking about your book as a part of a really important event for the library, the Adult Literacy Services and chapters. For people who have never been to an event, I know this will be your first event to go to. What's the event all about, chapters?
Well, I think the main point behind it is we're going to help raise some money for Adult Literacy Services in Tulsa to help the library reach out to adults. We are going to basically, Julia and David and I will be speaking about our writing, our books, and guests will rotate between the three of us. And as you rotate, there will be some wonderful hors d'oeuvres, appetizers from local restaurants. I'm not sure. I think there might be wine, but I know there will be food. And it will just be an evening to talk about books and the importance they play in our lives.
All right. That's the Chapters fundraiser coming up on Thursday, September 7th. You can contact the library for more information on that.
Mm-hmm.
Jennifer, thanks very much for joining us. And
thank
congratulations
you so much.
On a great book.
Thank you.
Tulsa author Jennifer Latham speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Her most recent book is titled Dreamland Burning. It's published by Little Brown. She'll be one of the featured authors at Chapters, Tulsa City County Library's fundraiser for adult literary services, coming up on Thursday, September 7th at Hardesty Regional Library, along with food writer David Leet and Tulsa mystery writer Julia Thomas. For more information, visit the tulsalibrary.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.